From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Zen meditation is in part about quieting the analytic mind. Like most writers, Lauren Schoenberg has an overactive analytic mind. Schoenberg's new memoir, Ambivalent Zen, is all about the paradoxes he's faced as an erotic American writer studying Zen Buddhism. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Schoenberg about those paradoxes and about his teacher, who became a monk in Japan at the age of six. Also, the story of Blue Note Records, perhaps the most famous jazz label in the world. We talk with Michael Kaskuna and Charlie Lurie, who've produced many Blue Note reissues and have collaborated on a new book of jazz photos by Blue Note's co-founder Francis Wolff. And Milo Miles reviews a new reggae reissue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A plane piloted by a California girl who was attempting to become the youngest person to fly a plane across the U.S. and back crashed this morning after taking off in a rainstorm in Cheyenne, Wyoming. All three people aboard were killed, 7-year-old Jessica Dubroff, her father, and her flight instructor. Bob Beck of Wyoming Public Radio has the latest.
It's in an area where there's a number of businesses, and it's roughly, my guess is about a half mile, three-quarters of a mile from the Cheyenne Airport. So it would have been a situation where it would have taken off. It would have kind of probably just gone up in the air and gone down. We had reports that it just narrowly missed a house and it crashed into a driveway. Latest report is the tail is intact. The front part of it, though, was spread out, and they've now covered a tarp over most of that area, of course, waiting for investigators to take a look at it.
Bob Beck of Wyoming Public Radio. Jessica Dubroff took off from Half Moon Bay, California on Wednesday. Her single-engine plane had been custom-fitted to allow her feet to reach the rudder pedals. She was trying to beat the record set by an 8-year-old from Phoenix who made the journey last year. But the Guinness Book of Records has stopped recognizing the youngest pilot category for fear of encouraging unsafe flights. The U.S. has been forced to suspend the daylight evacuation of foreigners from the capital of war-torn Liberia because of security considerations. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has ordered 3 warships and 700 Marines to the waters off the West African nation. The BBC's David Bamford reports from Freetown.
The American military operation to get civilians out of Monrovia by helicopter has been suspended because the situation on the ground has become too dangerous. Militiamen in control of streets and buildings close to the American embassy compound have begun firing off rocket-propelled grenades and machine gun fire when the helicopters come into land to pick up more evacuees. One helicopter had to urgently abort its approach because of concerns it might be hit. An American military spokesman at the Freetown Airport Transit Post said on security grounds, Operation Assured Response, as it's been called, is being switched to nighttime hours. Helicopter crews have been resting today, ready to resume flights after dark. Meanwhile, an American aircraft carrier, the Guam, with 500 to 600 men on board, is heading for Liberia.
The BBC's David Bamford reporting. Prices at the wholesale level increased 0.5% last month. That's the biggest increase in 3 months. The rise was fueled largely by a sharp jump in energy costs. Excluding the volatile energy and food categories, the so-called core rate of the producer price index edged up only 0.1%. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 21.5 points at 5,464 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton is proposing to reduce pension restrictions for small businesses and middle-class Americans. The changes would allow workers to withdraw money from 401k savings plans without penalty for first home purchases, children's education, and job retraining. Mr. Clinton said it's important to make pensions secure.
We have to make these pensions portable. This could help more than 5 million workers every single year. It means workers in new jobs will not have to wait to start saving in an employer pension plan.
There would also be simplified procedures for small businesses that want to establish 401k plans for their workers. Hospital sources in Beirut say 2 people were killed and 2 others wounded after Israeli helicopter gunships attacked Beirut's Shiite Muslim southern suburbs today. Edward Uranian reports from Beirut.
Israeli helicopters fired a number of rockets into parts of Beirut's southern suburbs, where the pro-Iranian Hezbollah has its stronghold. Eyewitnesses reported that damage was light, and that one rocket caused minor damage to offices used by Hezbollah. Lebanese army positions fired anti-aircraft guns at Israeli helicopters for more than 20 minutes. Residents of many parts of Beirut began going about their business after an initial panic. One foreign correspondent reported viewing pieces of aluminum shrapnel following the Israeli attack, suggesting it was intended to frighten Hezbollah more than to cause a great deal of damage. It was the first time Israel has attacked the Lebanese capital in more than 12 years. Hezbollah, which vows to drive Israeli troops out of southern Lebanon, rocketed parts of northern Israel Tuesday. For National Public Radio, I'm Edward Uranian in Beirut.
Representatives of 43 nations meeting in Cairo have signed an agreement not to build, test, or stockpile nuclear weapons. As part of the pact, the U.S., France, China, and Britain have pledged not to test or use nuclear weapons on the African continent. Russia is expected to sign on to the treaty later. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, the score.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Ambivalent Zen, begins with this paradoxical saying, "Nothing removes man further from God than the desire for union with him." Lawrence Schoenberg's new memoir about practicing Zen meditation is filled with paradoxes and, as the title suggests, with conflicted feelings. Lawrence Schoenberg learned that Zen can set you free, free you up, help you let go. But if you get attached to those goals, you will try too hard and merely become tense and self-conscious. Zen meditation is about learning to quiet the analytic mind, a near impossible goal for a neurotic Western writer like Schoenberg. In fact, Schoenberg is so fascinated by the human mind, he's written two books about how the brain works, one a biography of a neurosurgeon, the other a novel about amnesia. He's been practicing meditation at a Zendo or Zen center since the 70s. I asked him to describe sitting meditation.
Well, sitting meditation is very simple. I mean, some people have called it idiot practice. You know, you sit and pay attention to your mind. There are various strategies brought to bear on that. One, the earliest, the most beginning strategy in Zen is counting your breath. You count in exhalations usually until you get to 10, and then you start at 1 again. The main point of it is that when your mind wanders, as it certainly it does, it tends to fly in the face of that kind of concentration, not to blame yourself, but just to go on back to one and continue counting your breath. In that sense, you could say it's a practice in forgiveness, because whatever your mind is doing is what's important at that time.
But the idea when you're sitting is that you're not supposed to be thinking a lot of thoughts. You're supposed to watch the thoughts go by, but not get involved with them.
Right. We say don't chase after them. Pay attention to your thoughts, but don't chase after them. It's a very dangerous thing to come to it with any sort of idea. A lot of people come to it with the idea that they should empty their minds or be purified and compassionate while they're sitting on the cushion in order to continue that when they get up. But basically, you're just paying attention to whatever you are at that moment. The Buddha talked about the middle way as the basic principle of Buddhism. It's a moderation between extreme asceticism and extreme indulgence. And the same principle happens on the cushion. You try to pay attention to your thoughts, but not indulge them.
Meditation is in part about quieting the mind, about trying to quiet that endless chatter in the mind. Now, you're a writer, so, what you do is observe things, think about them, describe them in words. Give me a sense of some of the frustrations you've faced while sitting in meditation. As a writer, as somebody whose mind is always going, always thinking, always describing,
it's a gossip mind, you know, a commenting mind that you're trying to register what you're going to register what's happening and remember it in order to use it later. You could say it's gossip. The mind that led to this book, in a certain sense, is a very distracting mind on the cushion. But you know, that happens to be the mind that I my experience has developed in me. So I have to make use of it.
A while ago, when you were, I guess this is much earlier, when you were first learning to do sitting meditation, you were so, I think, at war with that voice in your head that's always chattering, the voice you were trying to silence during meditation, that you took 15 years' worth of your journals and took them to the dumpster and destroyed them.
Yeah, it's a great moment.
Well, I wonder if it's great or something you really regret.
I never regretted it. It was a great liberation. I regretted that I wasn't able to kill my diary writing habit. As you know from the book, I almost immediately started writing another one. But it was just a total self-indulgence, that diary. It was a kind of masturbation. And, you know, it was necessary when I did it. I think of a diary as a kind of a painkiller. And it's, you know, like any other painkiller, sometimes you need it, but you pay a price for it. And I think I paid a great price for keeping a diary then and now.
Well, how is it a painkiller, and what was the price that you paid?
It's the painkiller of any sort of analytic mind. You're kind of creating another, you're creating explanation. You're hooked on the drug of explanation, and it doesn't lead to anything but more need for more explanation or more confusion, in my view, and I think safe to say in the view of Zen. It was costly in the sense that it just generated more self-consciousness, and I don't think it helped me at all.
So you threw it out, you felt good afterwards, and then you started writing another journal.
Right.
So what's the point?
The point is that some diseases are incurable.
And did the nature of what you were writing in the journal change?
I think it's changed. It's maybe become a little more elegant or sophisticated or spiritual, but it's still a junk, in my opinion.
But you're still doing it.
Yep. Sorry to say, you know, I'm not the first person that Zen didn't make perfect.
Now, you told your Zen teacher that you feared that writing and sitting meditation were incompatible. And your teacher gave you this advice. He said, well, when you're sitting, just sit. And when you're writing, just write.
Yeah.
That sounds really good, but that's really hard, isn't it?
That's about the hardest thing in the world. And it's the essence of his teachings and probably of all Zen teachers. He said a great thing to me one day. When I was going through this conflict between Zen and writing, I would go to the Zendo and have these ecstatic periods of meditation and come back. And the more ecstatic I felt, the less I was able to work. And I told him about it, and he said, sure, your problem is you're attached to emptiness. You're not at your desk. When you go to your desk, you're still in the Zendo. And I think that's a great problem with many Zen students I've known. They become attached to this vision of emptiness, which becomes, it's a complete contradiction, because emptiness is not a, you can only be attached to forms, you can't be attached to emptiness. So immediately you're contradicting emptiness by becoming attached to some idea of it.
The literature of Zen Buddhism is filled with wonderful stories about Zen teachers. And I'd like to hear a little bit about your teacher. He's somebody who was a monk in Japan at the age of 6. He lived for a monastery in 17 years, spent 13 years in Israel, then moved to New York. How did you find him as a teacher?
You know, the Zen world is a very small one, and there are not many of these guys around. You know, there's a handful of Zen masters alive today. So when I was practicing, I mean, we all knew about him, that there was this guy in Israel, in the Arab quarter of Jerusalem, and he had a little Zendo there, and I had heard some great things about him, and I just had an instinct to go and meet him. And from the time I met him, actually, I thought that he embodied Zen more than any other teacher I had encountered. When I saw him there, I didn't expect I would ever see him again, but he turned up here in New York. He just decided to leave Israel and open a Zendo here. And from the time he got here, I was with him. I mean, I was studying with him.
When you say he embodied Zen, what does that mean?
Well, what you just said about his offering me that teaching of just sit when you're on your cushion, just sit, when you're writing, just write. To me, it's a wonderful idea, and any Zen teacher, or for that matter, any beginning Zen student knows it. But when you meet somebody like this, to me, he embodies that principle. He seems to be just doing whatever he's doing. If he's having a cup of tea, he's just having that cup of tea. When he's talking to you, he's just talking to you. It's a kind of, it can be a little disconcerting because he has, he's an amazingly concrete person. And he's got a kind of an energy that can be disturbing if you're not ready to hang in with him. You know, if you're not equally present with him, or if you want to get into some kind of conceptual discussion of Zen, he's not available for it at all.
I mean, he doesn't intellectualize it?
Not at all. No, he hasn't got that inclination. Now, some Zen teachers are quite brilliant at intellectualizing it, but he's not.
No, he was in some ways very strict with you. Do you think that's fair to say? Strict with his students?
I don't know about that. He was, the more he liked you, the more rough he could be, sometimes even brutal, in terms of calling your bluffs or trying to penetrate whatever
defenses
or pretentiousness as a or pieties. Zen mm-hmm. tends to generate a lot of piety and unfortunately pretentiousness, I think, in people. And he was great at puncturing that.
Can you give me an example?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a story in my book of a point soon after he got here when I was sitting on my own at my own home, and I thought I had a pure enlightenment experience, what in Zen practice is called Kensho. And it was, ecstatic, very immediate, a sense that all, that my mind was suddenly clearer than it had ever been. I was very excited by it. So I did something I'd never done before. When I got up from the cushion, I called him. And I described this whole experience to him, and he listened to me patiently. And then I think I knew already that I'd made a huge mistake. And he said, listen to me. He said, in the word Buddha, even the letter B is nothing but dust. And, in other words, it's just another stain on your mind. And that all this stuff that I was giving him was what I think would be called Zen stink. I was holding on to this kind of, holding on to a sensation. That's not what Zen is about. But I was trapped in it for the moment, and he got me out of it, and I felt very, at that moment, very resentful of him because he was taking something nice away from me. But it was good. It's a great help.
Yeah, and in contemporary parlance, he wasn't being supportive.
That's right. He's not supportive at all, and he can be, really much more brutal than that.
You, I think, are probably genetically skeptical.
Yeah, I think so.
which is a problematic trait to have, I think. So the impression I get is when you were studying with your Zen teacher, that on the one hand you'd be in his thrall, on the other hand there'd always be part of you standing back and being really skeptical. Do you think that stood in your way, or that was a decent trait to have?
I think it helped me. It kept me from. It made my commitment to him, I think, a little more intelligent rather than romantic. There's always a great danger in these practices that you're getting into your own neurotic dreams of salvation, being saved by this perfect guy out there who's not suffering like you're suffering, who's not ignorant like you're ignorant. And my own skepticism made me look at him, distance myself from him enough so that I could, I think, meet him on a more solid ground. It also, as the book makes clear, I think it saved me from some teachers who finally weren't really helping me.
I'd like to hear about some of those other teachers and how they weren't helping you.
Let me back up from that. Yeah. I think they helped me in some ways. Mm-hmm. There's certainly no teacher that I describe in the book that I'm not grateful to, mm-hmm. that didn't give me a lot. But you get to a certain point, and you're either going to keep going and remain committed to them, or see that, well, this is, you know, it's like a love relationship almost, and sometime it has to end. There's a great danger in these practices that because they require a surrender of your own ego is the first step toward opening your own mind to a teacher. Then they tend to generate a lot of self-effacement in the student and a lot of egomania and even sadism in some teachers who aren't mature enough to handle that kind of power. It doesn't mean that they are monsters or that they are completely, complete charlatans, but that some just, they have to be really mature to handle the kind of power that students are going to invest in them.
My guest is Lawrence Schoenberg, and he's written a new memoir called Ambivalent Zen about his Zen studies and about sitting in meditation. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lawrence Schoenberg. He's a writer, and for many years he's been practicing Zen Buddhism, sitting in meditation. He has a new memoir called Ambivalent Zen. Now, your father was a wealthy businessman. He owned a chain of stores in the South that sold clothes and cheap cosmetics and shoes and boots and things like that. And your teacher once said to you that your problem was you were a rich man's son, you lived the life of luxury. The implication here is that you never had to do anything you didn't want to do.
Right.
And that here you were, 49 years old, and you were still wandering around like a baby. Was that a good analysis?
I think it was right on the button. I couldn't argue with him. It was also why I was going to that cushion and trying to sit. You know, I think I recognized some of the costs, the softness that my own... affluent upbringing had generated, had engendered in me. So I was doing the best I could to counter it.
What were the costs?
Well, I think it made me very spoiled and arrogant in a lot of ways. And on a most concrete level, it gave me a low pain threshold. My tolerance for pain when I started Zen was very low, and if Zen gave me anything, it was in challenging that.
Do you think because you didn't have to have a job and make a living that it gave you too much time to think, and that reflection became too much of an obsession?
It's something I think about all the time. I don't know. I can't speak for anybody else. I know that obsession is very strong in me. I don't know that... I have, or people who have money have, any particular monopoly on it. One thing it certainly shows you is that material good fortune, like I've had, is not going to do anything about your fundamental suffering. If it made it possible for me to pay too much attention to my mind, I'm not sure. I know that in my own view, relatively speaking, I pay too much attention to my mind.
Right. Well, it maybe made it possible for you to not do things that would deflect your attention from your mind.
That's true.
In other words, you weren't forced to work. You weren't forced.
Well, that's what Roshi was. That's what he was trying to say. And he was always teasing me or pushing me about that. It's possible, but in some ways, maybe I as a writer, for example, it made me work harder, mm-hmm. made me more compulsive. As a writer, I think I've had a habit of being too much driven by, too much driven to prove myself against that.
Given all the frustrations you've had in sitting meditation, why have you never given it up? Why have you never just said, well, this isn't working, it's not for me, I'm not suited?
Because ultimately it makes more sense to me than anything. I can't imagine my life without it. It just, it's a very, very powerful, wonderful practice. And as the impulse of the mind, I think in general, but certainly of my mind, toward escape, toward anesthesia, say, of killing your pain, avoiding your pain, denying it, is demonic, and you need all the help you can to defeat that impulse. And Zen is just one, it's not the only way, obviously, but it's a great, powerful practice against that impulse to escape.
Where are you now in your Zen studies?
The same place. I still do it. Roshi's being in Japan has our center is very small, and we just go there and sit on our own. We treat it like a gym, and it's something I do every day. It's like brushing my teeth. Maybe an 45 minutes to an hour a day, or some days more, but that's generally the minimum.
Why do you go to a Zen center to sit in meditation? Why not just do it at home?
That's a great question. It's an important question. Zen is a communal practice. It's a, you get a lot from sitting with others. You get energy. When you sit alone, as of course one does, you become very vulnerable to a kind of self-importance, and again, the same old romantic trips, the ego trips, you start to think you're something, there's something special about doing this practice. If you go there, sit around, and you see a lot of schleps who look just like yourself, it's sort of hard to think it's anything special.
Lauren Shaneberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lauren Shaneberg is the author of the new memoir, Ambivalent Zen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Vision, a direct-to-desktop customized news service. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the story of Blue Note Records, the famous jazz label. Michael Cuscuna and Charlie Lorre have reissued many classic and previously unreleased Blue Note recordings on their own label, Mosaic. They've also collaborated on a new book of jazz photos by Blue Note's co-founder, Francis Wolfe. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charlie Lurie and Michael Koskuna describe Blue Note Records as one of the most visionary and artistically successful bodies of work in the history of the record business. The label was created in 1939, but it became best known for launching what became known as hard bop, with now classic 1950s sessions by Art Blakey, Horace Silver, and Lee Morgan. Blue Note also released important sessions by Thelonious Monk, Bud Powell, Cecil Taylor, Herbie Hancock, Clifford Brown, and Eric Dolphy. The label changed the lives of my guests Charlie Lurie and Michael Koskuna. They met at Blue Note in 1975 when Lurie, then the director of marketing for Blue Note, hired Koskuna to do research in the vaults. In 1982, they created their own reissue label, Mosaic Records, which first established itself by reissuing Blue Note masters which had been languishing in the vaults. Now Koskuna and Lurie have collaborated on a new book featuring the jazz photos of Blue Note co-founder Francis Wolfe. Their book also tells the story of Blue Note Records. This is one of the Blue Note classics, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers' 1958 recording, Moanin'. People mean by the Blue Note sound?
Well, I think basically the Blue Note sound is something that was born out of a desire by Art Blakey and Horace Silver in 1954 to create a sound in jazz that would appeal to people. It was kind of a low ebb for jazz at the time. There were a lot of people imitating what had been innovations during the bebop era, but there were no ensembles. There were no longer any big bands, and the stars of bebop were no longer around. And there were just throw-together jam sessions. And both Art and Horace felt that they needed to create something that would bring in blues and gospel and bring people back to jazz. So they really constructed something that became known as the Blue Note sound and also as hard bop, which was music that was very visceral and very intelligent at the same time. And Alfred Lion, who was the owner and creator of Blue Note Records, was really had a good feeling for soul, but was also a very meticulous person. And he was the kind of person that, in an age when it wasn't being done, would have paid rehearsals and work closely with musicians so that by the time they went into the studio, the improvisations would be fresh, but the ensembles would be precise and the full impact would be carried through.
What else would you say is among Blue Note's most important contributions to the history of recorded jazz?
Well, a great many people as they went along. It was, of course, the first label to record people like Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk and Wynton Kelly. And as they went into the 50s with the Blue Note sound that we just discussed, they were continually discovering and adding new people to the jazz lexicon. Lee Morgan, Wayne Shorter, and in the late into the early 60s when avant-garde became a force to be dealt with, they were able to pick a lot of the most intelligent people with the most focused and unique concept in music, like Andrew Hill and Gratian Moncourt. And they were also able to capture, by their meticulous way of planning and rehearsing before they went in the studio, to get the most spontaneous performance once there, they were able to get probably the most satisfying work out of people that were only briefly on the label, like John Coltrane and Cecil Taylor, and other major giants that passed through the label at various times.
How did Blue Note shape your listening?
Mine? Well, Blue Note was the first label that I started to collect when I got into jazz. Initially, I was just buying records that I liked, and somehow along the way, I realized that Blue Note was something I could always trust. The graphics made a Blue Note cover recognizable from 40 yards, and eventually it was the label that I began to trust its judgment, and when I wanted to spend that extra $5, which was a great deal of money in those days, to experiment and learn about a new artist, at least with Blue Note, it was a safe investment because it was going to be something of quality, whether I instantly liked it or not.
Charlie, what about you?
Well, I was born in 1940. I'm a little younger, a little older than Michael. So a lot of my tastes were already formed before I heard my first Blue Note album. I was listening to Benny Goodman and a lot of swing music. And I was a clarinet player myself. So those are the things that helped to shape me and direct my life. But as soon as I heard my first Blue Note album, and I believe it was a Horace Silver, my life changed. I had never heard music of that power and expressiveness before, and that simplicity. And from that point on, I became a convert, if you will, to Blue Note records. And as Michael says, the fact that it was on Blue Note for many people was the same for me. If it came out on Blue Note, I was interested in it. And just to hold those albums, just to look at them, the weight of the vinyl itself and the graphics, the Frank Wolf photos and the liner notes, it was there was a whole gestalt to the label that was tremendously appealing, and it was like an old friend after a while.
Talk to you both a little bit about what it's like for you to reissue jazz. Let's start with why you formed Mosaic, why you decided to start your own mail order business reissuing recordings from the past.
We were out of work, Terry.
That's a pretty direct answer.
No, aside from that, though, there was this is in the pre-CD era. And we're talking 1982,
mm-hmm.
and there was virtually nothing going on in the record industry with regard to jazz reissues, aside from what was going on at Fantasy with the twofers that they were putting out of Prestige and Milestone and Riverside Sessions. There was very, very, very little going on in the business with regard to jazz reissues. And there was a dearth of material in the marketplace. And a lot of great recordings were screaming to be available. There were new people coming along who had great need, great interest, great desire to be able to own this music and to learn from it and to enjoy it. And it just wasn't available.
My guests are Charlie Lurie and Michael Cascuna, authors of the new book, The Blue Note Years, The Jazz Photography of Francis Wolfe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Michael Cascuna and Charlie Lurie, co-founders of the jazz reissue label Mosaic Records. When you decided to start Mosaic, you had already put in a proposal to Capitol Records to reissue their music from their vaults, which included the Blue Note masters. They declined, and then you decided to start Mosaic yourselves and to start your own program of reissues. When you decided to do that, knowing that you'd have access to the Blue Note vaults through Capitol, why did you decide to go in the direction of box sets? This was in the dawn of the box set era.
Yes, actually, I think in many respects, Mosaic led the way and showed the rest of the industry that box sets were viable. There had been others prior to us, most notably the Miles Davis Chronicle on Prestige. But I think we took it a step further, and our feeling was that we wanted to put out complete bodies of work, that we did not feel we wanted to release individual compact discs and make decisions about or to do overviews of a career on one or two compact discs and make those kinds of decisions for people, that we felt that our goal would be better served if we were to identify seminal periods in an artist's recording career and explore that in its totality. And that meant sizable releases, anywhere from, in those days, we were just on LP, anywhere from two LPs to six or seven LPs in a set. And the concept dictated the size of it. We did not dictate the size of it. Whatever the body of work amounted to would determine the size of the set.
The first box set that you put out was a Thelonious Monk Blue Note box set. Michael, why was that the first one?
Well, that was the first one because that's really what caused us to think of box sets as a concept and a vehicle for reissues. And the reason was that puttering around the Blue Note vaults, I had found about 30 minutes of unissued Thelonious Monk. The problem with 30 minutes of unissued Thelonious Monk is it's not enough for an LP. And it was that led me in a desperation to get that material out to figure out how to do it. And then I realized the way to do it is to throw everything back in, make it chronological, and make it complete. And that's what set us on a course for box sets. It was born out of necessity. The Thelonious Monk set was a very important part of his career, and it had a lot of gems on it, a lot of unissued tunes and a lot of alternate takes.
Why don't you choose something to play for us that hadn't been issued until you brought out that box set?
Well, I think one of the things that I was most intrigued about when I went through the Thelonious Monk vaults was that there was a take of Well You Needn't that might have been chosen. It was just as good as the master take, except that he played the melody very differently. And had this version been the one that was released on 78, hundreds of or maybe thousands of musicians would be playing this tune very differently right now. And it is a jazz standard. And this is Monk's other concept on Well You Needn't.
Now, this Monk recording that we're listening to, this box set, was back in the disc era. I mean, in the vinyl era. This was the pre-CD period. You're still doing vinyl as well as CDs now. Why are you still releasing some things on vinyl?
Well, there are still a lot of people that that want vinyl. There are a lot of people that didn't retool for CD. There are a lot of people that don't like the sound of CDs. A lot of people that are very much against digital recording. And I may say there is some truth to that, but a lot of people were turned off by it because so many CDs came on the market initially, and they almost all sounded horrible. They were just junior engineers cranking out the wrong master tape and throwing them on the market in a way that shows the worst side of the record industry. And a lot of people were very, very rightfully turned off to CDs. I think digital recording and CDs is a far more fleshed out and viable format right now. But a lot of people prefer vinyl. And a lot of people with very high-end hi-fi sets with tube amplifiers and state-of-the-art turntables much prefer the warmth and the ambience and the overtones that you can get from an analog recording that digital, by definition, shortcuts.
When you started Mosaic in the early 80s, Capitol wasn't interested yet in a jazz reissue program, so you got access to a lot of these recordings for your own series. But since the switchover from vinyl to CDs, I think a lot of companies have realized that they're sitting on really, really important and saleable material in their vaults, and a lot of companies have been reissuing their music onto CD now. How has that affected your ability to put out recordings from the vault?
Well, I suppose we never would be able to get a name like Thelonious Monk or the Jerry Mulligan Pacific Jazz recordings at this point in time. But there's such a wealth of recorded jazz, especially from the end of World War II up to the invasion of the Beatles. It was a very fertile period, and a great deal of recording was being done. And there's a lot of stuff that labels will never, ever get to, and that their distribution companies will not be interested in carrying or maximizing. So there are always concepts that are very important that we can do that just complement what the companies do.
One of your recent box sets features the work of trumpeter Lee Morgan. Tell us what the focus is on this.
Lee Morgan was one of those people that stayed with Blue Note for almost his entire professional life. And whereas a lot of his 60s recordings are things that would be too strong for Mosaic to get, on this particular set that we've just recently put out, we focused on his 50s stuff at a point when he was younger and his records didn't have the popularity that his later material did. Nonetheless, it is some of his best work and some of his most fascinating work. And this set brings to light a very important early part of his career.
Well, Michael Cascuno, Charlie Lorre, thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Charlie Lorre and Michael Cascuno collaborated on the new book, The Blue Note Years, The Jazz Photography of Francis Wolfe, which includes their extensive essay on the history of Blue Note. Lorre and Cascuno are the founders of Mosaic Records, a reissue label available only through mail order. Their new box set, the complete Blue Note Lee Morgan 50s sessions, includes this previously unissued take of Just One of Those Things. Coming up, a reissue of a reggae masterpiece. This is Fresh Air. Legendary lost reggae album has been reissued, and music critic Milo Miles says it lives up to its mythic past. It's the Congos recording Heart of the Congos. Milo says the 1977 reggae masterpiece captures a singular burst of creativity from everyone involved, singers, musicians, and producer.
For a harmony group, the Congos were spare but potent. Blessed with a wondrous airborne falsetto, singer Cedric Mighton got together with hearty tenor Roy Johnson to form the Congos in 1976. They approached old acquaintance Lee Scratch Perry about recording an album at his Black Ark studio. It was a fortuitous choice. Perry was an inspired producer with a wild imagination and an ear to match. He combined a fascination with technology and a passion for earthy sound and tough rhythms. His Black Ark studio in Kingston was running at full steam. It offered an exciting, unpredictable place to work and attracted top hands like veteran guitarist Ernest Rangling, organist Winston Wright, and the funky percussionist Noel Scully Sims. Perry rounded out the vocals with backup singers like the Silk Smooth Meditations. And the set of recordings that would be known as Heart of the Congos was set to go. Like albums by Burning Spear from the same period, Heart of the Congos is a sort of dictionary of Rastafarian soul. The symbolism in the songs can baffle non-believers, but the activist force of the Rasta faithful comes through powerfully. At times, there are echoes of the righteous grace shaped by Curtis Mayfield in The Impressions, one of the great reggae vocal models. There are no real love songs on Heart of the Congos, but the salvation sure is sensual. The album suffered a sad fate, however. Accounts differ, but it was either rejected or never offered to Island Records. Nobody remembers why, except that Perry's relationship with the label was winding down. Heart of the Congos has been released and reissued at least 5 times, always on tiny labels, always incomplete or muddy sounding, or both. The Congos never recorded anything nearly as good and disbanded a few years later. Their moment of glory gets its due with this new reissue on the Blood and Fire label. It's a handsome package illustrated with vigorous folk art collages. It includes concise liner notes by Steve Barrow, and it gathers every scrap of music associated with the album, including extra numbers and a second CD with 5 rare remixes. Reggae albums with such joy and confident aspirations made the style popular all over the world 20 years ago. No reggae album more obscure than Heart of the Congos is as rich, and no richer collection is as obscure. As the first song on the record puts it, those who would save their souls must row to reach the higher ground, and no one gets the parable across better than the Congos.
Milo Miles is a writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He reviewed Heart of the Congos on the Blood and Fire label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurek directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Watch you beg the Caliban, I'll be best Cali weed in town.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of The Size of Thoughts, Essays and Other Lumber by Nicholson Baker. This is NPR, National Public Radio.